What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
It's Jim Cramer here. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street. Don't miss a minute of the action.
Good Wednesday morning. Welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm Carl Quintanilla with David Faber, Mike Santoli at Post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. Cramer has the morning off. Coming off that record close, futures mixed as we sit in this brief data vacuum today between CPI yesterday and PPI retail sales tomorrow. Bonds are under pressure, 10-year approaching 4.2. Our roadmap begins with momentum fueling this market's record run. How concerned should we be about unwind risk?
We are also counting down to that House vote on legislation, which could result in TikTok being banned in the United States. Plus, Tesla, quote, ain't looking so magnificent. That is the view of Wells Fargo, the firm slapping that EV maker with the equivalent of a sell rating.
Let's begin with this ongoing market rally. As we said, S&P is coming off that record close, posting its best day yesterday in March. A lot of discussion. We were talking about the Wells note today about disjointed momentum trade going on in front of Friday, Mike.
Yeah, it has been a little bit agitated. Now, this has been a sort of a fuse that people have been watching potentially burn down, this idea that the market was over-reliant on these pure momentum winners. So last Friday and then this Monday, you did see a reversal. You saw it really mostly absorbed in the way of rotation. So NVIDIA down, you know, 10% high to low, other stuff in the momentum basket. And laggards took up the slack. Yesterday, a little bit of a reversal. It was a bounce. I feel like, you know, it's admirable that the market is able to repair itself this way in an ongoing basis. It's a bull market. The pullbacks have been shallow. They've been brief. But it still hasn't relieved a lot of what could be the excesses within it, which is, you know, the extreme outperformance of things like semis and the extreme reliance on a day-to-day basis on sometimes a handful of names. Yesterday was kind of a 50-50 market breath day, and yet you had the best day in March and you got a new record. So I think that's why people are still a little bit on guard about the field position. The market's in a, you know, you mentioned it's quiet on the macro front. Yields have been levitating a little bit within their range. And what that has tended to mean is whatever broadening action you would expect, you know, if the economy is going to be great, it gets halted when yields go up. So January 5th of this year was the low in yields. It was the high for the equal weight S&P relative to the NASDAQ. And so you see this dynamic out there where, you know, only the secular winners can perform when yields are going up and you're not going to get a rate cut very soon. So I think that's where we are. Sentiment seems pretty elevated. Some new data this morning, investors' intelligence, pretty extreme. So, you know, it makes all the sense in the world to expect this market to cool off. It hasn't done so yet.
Right. This was sort of the topic, David, of Sarah's discussion with Ken Griffin yesterday about there really being two separate risk profiles in the market right now. There is the AI trade, and then there's the less expensive sort of industrial base trade that he talked about.
Yeah, talking about both. And of course, perhaps not a surprise and not necessarily something our viewers are not well aware of, which is NVIDIA looks pretty good.
Yeah.
He seemed to think, Carl.
Channel checks?
He kind of likes it. Yeah.
He says they're operating at the top of their game. He's been doing his
channel checks.
Yeah.
And it looks good. It looks good. We can take a listen, I think, to what Mr. Griffin had to say to Sarah Eisen.
None of us know where we are in this journey. What I will tell you is the team in NVIDIA looks like they're really on top of their game right now.
Yes.
I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. They have done just an incredible job. This is like the gold mining in California. Those that sold the picks made a lot of money. And it's very clear that NVIDIA right now sells one of the most important ingredients in the AI story. And they've done an incredible job of capitalizing on it. What's really interesting to see is that the large language models, the barriers to the production of a world-class model appear to be somewhat lower than we had thought they were 9 months ago or 12 months ago. I mean, if you look at just recent events, you know, Anthropic's most recent model release is a real competitor to what's been done at OpenAI. And that's one hell of a statement. And in fact, I think you could argue that there
You're not an investor in Anthropic, right?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not. Just seeing if I'm chalking my book.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Transparent. No, go on. So So they're competitors. We want to find out who the next NVIDIA is.
I don't know who the next NVIDIA is going to be. I don't know where AMD is going to get on their race against NVIDIA. I don't know where Intel is going to get. But right now, NVIDIA sits in a pretty good position.
Interesting to listen to. I mean, in terms of powering the large language models, that point he made that an Anthropic can become a competitor in the sense of perhaps you don't need quite as much computing power. And it's not just the hyperscalers who can play in this game. That said, of course, coming back to the overall theme, which is NVIDIA is the Levi Strauss
Exactly.
Like the same way they were during the game.
And, you know, if you want to extend that a little bit, what he implicitly is saying there is what we know for sure is, and what the market is confident of and is willing to give a high probability of success for is massive amounts of upfront capital investments happening right now. There's supply shortages. The payoff ultimately down the road for running AI models or creating them is very much up in the air, and maybe it ends up just being kind of a broad-scale productivity boost type of thing as opposed to, you know, many, many fabulous business models that grow out of it. But it's too early to make that call, and the market is saying all we know is whether it makes sense or not, people have to, you know, invest headlong in this area.
It's interesting because he also said that as of right now, a lot of these LLMs are not that smart. They're just good at aggregating what's already existing on the internet. And you've talked a bit this morning on Squawk about the market's search for a second savior.
It keeps looking for, you know, wanting to look at these existing companies and saying, you know, do they have the magic? And so obviously it happened with Broadcom. They clearly are a player in this area, and the market revalues it in a hurry, like in a step function. And then it happened to Dell last week, and arguably Oracle this week.
You know, the Dell move, which was a significant one, when you look deeper into it in terms of what they're actually putting in the data center, the Dell server, obviously it was the inclusion of the NVIDIA chips. NVIDIA chip is most of the money there. The margins on that product for Dell are not particularly large.
Right.
It's not particularly profitable. Yes, they were absolutely a beneficiary of the fact that they seemed to have access to chips that perhaps some of their competitors did not. But I do think it's important. I believe Michael Dell even was open about this. It's not like this is a huge profit-making opportunity. Because, frankly, they're paying for those chips the same way, and they represent 75% of the overall value, or whatever it may be, of what they're putting in the data center.
There's no doubt about that, and I think what's key about the reaction when it came to Dell stock is it was starting at 12 times earnings.
Right.
So when you have a stock that's priced for essentially no growth long term, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, we got this cycle we can ride for a little while, and we are, you know, and again, with the scarcity of ways to actually leverage it in the market, you get some benefit from that.
Right.
And the question is whether it's durable.
But even in that case, it seems the real value ultimately was NVIDIA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it does come back.
And by the way, poetically today, B of A takes NVIDIA to 1100 from 925. They say the forward, the calendar 25 forward PE 37 is within a large range of the 20s to the 60s. And they up SMCI on exposure to the AI server network.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, we're almost a quarter through the year, so we can start talking about 2025. We can start talking about the PE range that NVIDIA's had in the last couple of years. It's all a way for people to say that the story's not over, as he calls it, ahead of AI Woodstock.
All right, let's move on to the legislation that is in the House today. It could ban TikTok in the U.S. over concerns that the social media app is a threat to national security, given its ties to China. Emily Wilkins is in D.C. and brings us the latest. Emily.
Hey, David. Well, yeah, in less than an hour now, the House is expected to not only vote, but to pass a bill that would give TikTok an ultimatum, either divest from Chinese parent company ByteDance or be banned in the U.S. But while the bill sped through the House, the road ahead is going to get tougher for this piece of legislation. TikTok has ramped up lobbying efforts against the bill, and the CEO, Shouzi Chu, is expected to be in D.C. this week for meetings. Now, dozens of video creators on TikTok met with lawmakers yesterday, and they also held a press conference with a handful of progressive lawmakers who oppose the bill, including Maxwell Frost, who said the roughly six-month window that TikTok would have to find a new owner under the legislation would not be enough time.
It's unreasonable to believe that in 180 days that a buyer will be found and that the deal can move forward, which would result in TikTok being banned. Whether it's banned for a year or 2 years or 6 months, a ban is a ban.
The bill also lacks a clear path in the Senate right now. I spoke with senators yesterday, and they told me that they share the national security concerns that the House has, but they've got some other issues that they're worried about. These include things like freedom of speech, whether the bill singles out and punishes TikTok in an unconstitutional way, and the ramifications of getting rid of a popular app among 170 million American users. Congressman Mike Gallagher, who chairs the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party and is one of the bill's main backers, has said that this bill has been tailored to avoid past pitfalls to other bans on TikTok, such as measures that are too targeted against a single company.
What our bill is a regulatory framework. It is prospective for companies that are controlled by a foreign adversary. It's a regulatory framework, not a punitive framework, and therefore I think any concerns over a bill of attainder simply don't obtain in this case.
Senators also told me that they're waiting to see what the House does before taking a closer look at the bill. So this is going to be an interesting vote to watch. If nearly all House members support the bill, we're not expecting it to be unanimous, but it could be close. The pressure is really going to be on the Senate to act. David?
Thank you, Emily. Emily Wilkins in D.C. And, of course, an interesting journal story today about how perhaps the company may have been surprised at just how swiftly this effort was undertaken, somewhat furtively as well. So it sort of was a surprise. They kind of thought they were in a good place when President Biden, for example, joined TikTok around the Super Bowl. I continue, Mike, to just focus on what would it mean if it actually happened? How do you do this? You know, you have enormous amount of potential value here in the U.S. in terms of TikTok and what it means to the parent company ByteDance, though, frankly, ByteDance has an enormous business in China, don't forget. And it's easy to say, well, you'd have to just divest it or close it down. Much harder to do. And again, the source code and the algorithm, they're not going to go along with this thing. And so it just becomes a very interesting but difficult dance if, in fact, this actually is something that gets passed.
Right.
Obviously, it also will be challenged in the court, so who knows when it would actually have to occur.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing in that sense. And also, you know, there's even a sense out there. I mean, have they made the case about the national security threat, specifically in terms of the harvesting of data, the use of user details, or is it just... Look, this is a channel through which, you know, hostile actors have propagated messages, and the Chinese, you know, authorities maybe can have some sway. So whether that matters or not, probably not for the vote, but
maybe not for the vote. But it's not clear that they have made that case. I don't think, Carl. Yeah. I'm not aware of specific instances they've cited where there has been potentially Chinese control. That said, of course, it's something you're not going to see most likely if it's done well.
Although Sorkin tried to get, you know, it out of Cruz in the last hour on Squawk, saying, do you have evidence, even classified, that you can just share generically about risk and hard to get? By the way, comment from the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson saying this kind of bullying behavior is used when one can no longer win fair competition. The U.S. will only hurt itself. Their essential argument is that this is going to erode confidence of international investors in deploying money in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the... retributions, if you want to call it that. At some point, ByteDance will go public. It certainly won't be here in the United States, one would imagine. It would be in Hong Kong. And by the way, it would be one of the largest single IPOs. We've talked about the fact that the company most recently valued, or at least trading in that secondary market that existed, about $220 billion. But that may be quite low, given how much cash they have, the $25-plus billion that I'm told in operating income this company has. Yeah. I mean, you can think about a multiple there in terms of what this thing really may be worth. Even a 10-cent multiple gets you to an enormous value, one of the most valuable private companies in the world by far.
Well, look for that vote beginning at 10 a.m. Eastern before the House GOP goes to their retreat. We'll watch some retailers today. Dollar Tree, the biggest laggard on the S&P this morning, as they're going to close hundreds of stores, and they do guide below on Q1 revenue. We'll get to some autos. We mentioned that downgrade of Tesla, a lot of news in the airlines, specifically regarding that Alaska Airlines flight. A lot more when we come back.
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back. It's 3 weeks. Three, I don't know, which three do you do? Anyway, 3 weeks until shareholders vote on that proxy battle that is ongoing at Disney, where Nelson Peltz and Jay Rasulo are trying to get seated on Disney's board of directors. And both sides are fully engaged, as you might expect, in trying to weigh shareholders to their side, with various presentations hitting almost every day, one from either side in terms of arguing their case. Obviously, Trian's argument, hey, the performance of this stock price has not been good over a long period of time. We need to be on this board to ensure that, in fact, shareholders are looked after. Disney, for its part, spending a lot of time with its own shareholders. In fact, I know Bob Iger, Boston, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., you name it, sort of visiting with various shareholders, because again, this is sort of the heat of the moment right now in terms of both sides making their arguments, large shareholder bases being the key. So the institutions that control many of those shares, as you might expect, are getting their chance to hear from Mr. Iger, for example. In my various reporting and just talking to any number of people, as I try to do on occasion, Disney has come up. And in fact, I can share the following from one Jamie Dimon. Our viewers may know who that is. Of course, the CEO and chairman of J.P. Morgan. He's decided to weigh in here with his own comments in terms of where he sees things going and what he wants, and gave me the following statement. Bob is a first-class executive, an outstanding leader who I've known for decades. He knows the media and entertainment business cold and has a successful track record to prove it. It's a complicated industry filled with creative talent, requiring the unique expertise and engagement skills that Bob possesses. Putting people on a board unnecessarily can harm a company. I don't know why shareholders would take that risk, especially given the significant progress the company has made since Bob came back. That, again, a comment that I was given from Jamie Dimon. I should make the point that J.P. Morgan has advised Disney in the past on defensive matters, for example, in dealing with activists. So they are and have been paid by Disney. That said, Dimon, I don't recall him ever weighing in on a proxy battle previously, and so I think it was newsworthy, his interest in doing so here. Obviously, he is squarely behind Bob Iger. And I think sort of the background in some way to those kinds of comments is simply, listen, you know, shareholders may believe that in these kinds of situations, you know, it's not a big deal to add even just one board member, but CEOs argue differently. You know, they would argue, as Jamie is here, that restructuring the leadership or adding one or two different voices that are, you know, that are not necessarily not just discordant, but actively working against the CEO, as Bob Iger would argue is going to be the case here, really is disruptive in what is a transformational period for Disney. And that gets to sort of this idea of risk. You know, whether or not right or wrong, Bob Iger views much of this Trian effort really as Ike Perlmutter's effort. And Ike Perlmutter and Bob Iger do not see things the same way. Perlmutter has tried to get Iger fired in the past, certainly didn't want him to come back. And it is the perception, I believe, that if, in fact, Trian were to win one or two board seats, Iger believes that it's Perlmutter who is behind it and therefore would make his life very difficult. And so you do have to raise at least the question of the instability of management. If, in fact, Trian were to win a seat or two, would you keep that management in place? Would they be willing to stay? Would Bob Iger say, you know what, As much as I love the company, this is not something that I'm interested in dealing with. So that certainly is something as well that shareholders may want to at least keep in mind at this point. As we continue to monitor, guys, what is going to be an interesting vote. The institutions play the key role here. Not that retail is not of great importance. And both sides making their strong arguments as to why they feel, of course, that Rizzullo and Peltz say they should be on the board, and as much that Iger and Disney says this is not what we need right now. We are on the right course. We do not need so-called rabble-rousers in the boardroom who are going to make life very difficult in terms of getting things done.
You know, and David, as this battle has gone on, arguably it's become harder to argue that Disney has somehow misplayed the hand that it had relative to traditional media competitors. If you just look at the way the stocks have performed and the valuations that still are in place, you know, there's always been this question of, you know, okay, exactly what should have been done differently. You can't go back and not buy Fox, the Fox assets, which is one of the criticisms of Peltz, that it was a bad deal. Well, at this point, you have what you have.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, Peltz, they would make the argument, obviously, of significant underperformance during a period of time versus the S&P.
Sure.
But if you compare it to a Paramount or a Warner Brothers Discovery, exactly, it's a very different story, to your point. Now, they're different companies, and
yes,
Parks obviously helps fuel the earnings at Disney, and they have used that to try to create a profitable direct-to-consumer business. And Carl, that continues to be the key question that many of the shareholders have in terms of when will they get to that profitability. Obviously, last quarter for Disney was a major, major advance in terms of those goals.
Right. What is it? Well, it's extremely confident.
Yes.
In Q4.
Yes.
Watch it closely. But Jamie's right about it being a complicated business, full of artistic personalities, difficult management exercise. That's good stuff. We'll take a quick break here. Countdown to the opening bell. A lot more Squawk on the Street when we return.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Awaiting the opening bell here. I'll take a look at futures one last time as we get set for the bell and the CNBC real-time exchange, the big board this morning. It is Elevest, an investing and wealth management company for women, built by women. Founder, CEO Sally Krawcheck is going to join us on set in about an hour. And at the NASDAQ, it's Dealmakers, a community of female C-suite leaders and investors in the retail and consumer spaces. Speaking of which, Mike, got a lot of retail news out of Williams-Sonoma and Dollar Tree and Petco, too.
We did. Dollar Tree is, you know, a little bit of a messy set of guidance, I guess, is the way the street is taking it anyway. Going to be closing a ton of Family Dollar stores. Remember, that was the merger. Stock opening up down 11.5%. Even leading into the number, there was some questions around, you know, the pacing of tax refunds and all the macro stuff that's gone into that. And it seems as if just, you know, even though the consumer in general has been hanging in there, and the question is exactly how much fatigue you're seeing in that segment of households. So this reset lower, basically the guidance sort of bracketed the consensus, but definitely with a downward skew. So seeing the results there, it's a it's almost $30 billion market cap company, but Walmart has been the clear preference along with Costco in anything related to broad discount.
Those who are positive on the stock, Mike, I think making an argument that the underlying comps for Dollar Tree are actually accelerating on a 2- and 4-year basis.
Yeah.
I'm just reading some notes here. So the notion this is a setback to the bull case, perhaps overblown. At least that's one side. The other being, hey, listen, they came in 16% below the street. So.
Well, that's the thing.
In terms of guidance, I should say.
Yeah, and there was a little bit of a sense out there that they were going to benefit from an extra week in the fourth quarter. So it was a little messy and sort of seeing the impact right here. Williams-Sonoma, on the other hand, Still doing pretty well.
Nice. Take a look at the chart, up 10% almost this morning. 544 beats 515. Gross margins beat. Comps fell a little bit less than expected. Nice 25% div hike. They boost the buyback. They actually tweak higher their long-term operating margin guidance. Interesting, given, well, sort of the atmosphere around housing in general, Mike. Mortgage apps today, 4-week high as the fixed goes back below 7.
Yeah, that that trade has been recharged a bit. You've seen the builders themselves do a little bit better. And yeah, we're testing just exactly how sensitive people are going to be with a downtick. These little moves in rates. Williams-Sonoma seems like they have pricing power and all the rest of it. So it's not so much big ticket appliance. It's just they seem to be in the general area of merchandise people want to be.
I know the JP Morgan desk this morning pointed out that the XHB, the Home Builders ETF, outpacing the S&P pretty nicely month to date and over the past month by about 300 basis points.
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I've put it up multiple times that the home builders and the semis have moved really close with one another, even over a one-year basis. You wouldn't think that it could keep pace with semis, but it's almost a similar thought process behind it, which is massive supply constraints, therefore pricing power. Also long-run secular drivers that are, you know, hard to necessarily address. So demographics, shortage of homes, and of course we know what's going on in semi. So, I mean, it's a smaller group. It's not actually, you know, something that's going to drive the overall market. But if this is one of those arguments that if housing gets recharged, you know, we had our downturn there. Manufacturing is perking up. Inventories look like they're at a good place. Now, one group will say, well, that could rekindle inflationary pressures. The other says, you know, this is essentially this sort of rolling reset of the economy that's already happened. And so consumers are getting a little hesitant. You're seeing a little bit of fraying in the labor market. You know, the Fed's own labor market indicator has rolled pretty decisively. I think we should take the Fed at its word, Powell at his word, when he says the risks are balanced right now. You know, he really wants to emphasize that. And I think they're cognizant of not waiting too long, because if June's the first cut, it's 11 months at pause at the highs in rates. That's a long time. And the only longer one, I believe, was ahead of the financial crisis.
Well, there was one chart circulating yesterday from NFIB. You know, they ask employers, is quality labor your number one problem? And that has fallen off a cliff, which a lot of people read as being quite bearish for the labor market.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's interesting because NFIB, directionally, it does correlate with all the macro stuff, but it's super small businesses, right? It's a lot of owner-operator. I think 75% is like under 10 employees or something like that. But still, it does have a lot of materiality for the big picture in terms of can you find people?
Yeah. Although what gets housing going other than lower rates?
Lower rates and pent-up demand, I think, is the idea. And the idea that the people who have waited to put their homes on the market because they were locked in, that just sort of wears off over time.
Right.
Like, you just have to move.
You have to do it.
Or you need a bigger place, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I think that's
back to the 5 D's, right, David?
Yes. That's right. You love those 5 D's.
Diapers, diplomas, diamonds,
divorce,
and death.
There you go.
Right. Life goes on.
Yeah.
Exactly. It does. But right now, we still have new home sales as a percent of overall far higher. Far.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 30%
exactly.
or more. Yeah. When it's usually 10.
Yeah, in a way, it's still a clogged market in that sense. So it's not operating normally. Yeah, I would.
Guys, we mentioned Tesla at the top of the program, but we haven't gotten back to this Wells Fargo downgrade. A growth company with no growth seems to be one of the key theses they are laying out there. Growth in core markets has moderated, with EU and China flattish in the last 12 months. U.S. down since the second quarter, says Wells. More concerning, they say, is the effect of price cuts are moderating, with the second half volume up only 3%, that half over a year ago half, despite pricing that is down 5%. So the cuts have resulted, obviously, in a reduction in profitability of as much as $6,800 per car.
Yeah. They go on to say that in the wake of price cuts, you wind up with, as they say, lower lease residuals. We've seen that at some of the rental fleets. Disgruntled customers and the possible loss of the brand premium. 125 is 30% downside.
Yeah.
And they were at 200. It's not quite as draconian as the Deutsche downgrade earlier in the week, where they went to 218. But yeah, that's a bearish view. It's even below Bernstein, which has been at 150 forever.
Exactly. I mean, the radically cut earnings estimates in the Wells Fargo downgrade, they're looking for $2 this year. The consensus is 303. They're looking for $1.90 in 2025. The consensus is 416. So obviously, the call here is that the street is asleep in terms of the longer term dynamics. And just for benchmarking sake, the company earned $4 in 2022. So in terms of that sort of static profitability at best, and now it looks like, if Wells is right, the slide, it makes it look much more expensive, obviously, as a stock, 90 times next year's earnings. I think what I would be looking for is the stock to actually rally on one of these calls, and where you have this sense out there that, yeah, it doesn't look great, but it's in the price, and we already have people washed out of it.
What's interesting, too, is that Morgan Stanley today, Adam Jonas, actually lifts the U.S. autos as a sector. He talks about better capital discipline, better capital return, lower spending on EVs and AVs, better restructured portfolios, better collaboration. 10% upside, he says, to our targets across the U.S. auto space.
Yeah, interestingly, 10% upside, 7 if you exclude Tesla.
Exactly.
So he still loves Tesla.
Yes.
He still has his big integrated bullish call on Tesla in terms of the price target. But it seems like he's sort of articulating the GM story of recent months.
Right, where there have been some really interesting executive moves in the past 24 hours.
Yeah.
One was Mike Abbott, the former Apple executive who joined to be their software czar, is leaving. And then they hire this former Tesla executive to be the new head of manufacturing at GM.
And just the idea of we're just going to throttle back on battery vehicles to some degree and share some cash with shareholders, as of course GM has done. So stock has had a decent run. So it is interesting, and you wouldn't think that you would make that call if you thought the economy was going to obviously stumble hard.
Finally, Musk did make his way to the German Gigafactory in the wake of that arson attack. We might have some video as they look. They got power back now, looking to give more clarity on when they can actually resume production. The other story I would add, guys, is this piece out of the South China Morning Post about BYD pricing their new compact SUV at the equivalent of $12,000 US. $12,500 for a compact electric SUV.
Amazing.
Wow.
Which has implications.
It's almost like a disposable car.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like so many things from China.
They'll
send us clothes. You can put them for a year or two. All right, I'll get a new one.
Like fast fashion for the car.
I was going to say, this next model that Tesla is looking to come out with is kind of a compact SUV.
The Model 2.
Yeah. So it's tough to be profitable as it is.
We're going to talk to Dan Ives next hour about why he still thinks this negative sentiment on Tesla is overdone, sees a $1 trillion valuation still possible as these new models, lower cost models, roll in.
Channel checks. He's been doing his channel checks, Carl. Sorry, guys.
Rent a Tesla a couple of weeks ago.
And what'd you think, Mike?
It was fine. It was a real souped-up golf car.
That's all you got to say?
Golf car. Massively impressed with the supercharger experience.
Oh, that's good.
That I'll say. Yeah.
Okay. Guys, Alphabet's back in the green for the year. Kind of interesting to note, given a lot of concerns there, as we've discussed. The innovator's dilemma, sort of a bigger story playing out over a longer period of time in terms of what they will do as they respond to generative AI and what that may mean to search. And Meta shares are down. It's been an interesting week for Meta. Down, up, down. In part, they would be a beneficiary, seems little doubt, if in fact TikTok were to actually be banned in the U.S. Now, despite what may be a positive vote from the House today, sending that legislation on to the Senate, as Emily Wilkins detailed, there's still quite a ways to go here for this thing to become law. Meta would be a beneficiary. Donald Trump, former President Trump, agrees. Said as much on Monday, which is why he's reversed himself on his ban at TikTok. But did you guys notice Meta shares on Monday were down sharply?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you did wonder whether, in fact, was because of some of the comments that former President Trump made on Squawk Box.
I wondered that too. And
either, Mike, but I heard from some people they thought it was.
You can't disprove it for sure, and it's plausible. I would just say it's very difficult to separate out the fact that that was day two of the momentum, Meta, if you just look at the S&P 500 momentum basket, it's NVIDIA 12%, Meta 11.4%. So it's hard to know if it really was that. And we did bounce yesterday in those category of stocks.
It did, and it had a decent bounce yesterday. And guys, a story again from earlier on Monday that I didn't really pay close attention to, even though we had focused on it a bit, was, of course, when Choice Hotels gave up its bid to try to acquire Wyndham. Remember, they'd been going after directors. They had an exchange offer out there. It was a very aggressive, hostile offer. There was concern that had been raised numerous times by Wyndham about the antitrust effects. But I would note an interesting choice here by the FTC yesterday that I can rarely remember seeing in the past. They didn't comment on the potential antitrust ramifications of this deal while Choice was trying to buy Wyndham. But they chose to come out yesterday and say, hey, you know what? We were taking a close look at this thing. And just so you know, we thought it would have been a really serious competition question that would have been raised. And so the fact that they decided to not pursue it is a win for consumers. I thought that was odd, given there was no reason for them to weigh in whatsoever. They had not done so during the course of Choice's attempts to acquire Wyndham. And by the way, it wasn't clear that it even fell apart as a result of antitrust, though that certainly was one of the reasons raised, key reason by Choice as to why they didn't want to, Wyndham, why they didn't want to engage. It was just that exchange offer never found takers. Yeah. The ARBs never got interested in this deal. But anyway, just I thought it weird that they chose to weigh in after the
I
fact.
Guess it would seem gratuitous unless they felt there's value in, you know, putting that flag out there and saying this is the kind of thing, if you're considering it, we wouldn't look too kindly.
That is the reason. That is the reason. They're trying to stay relevant, I guess, over there.
Yeah. Meanwhile, also we're in the travel space. Goldman initiating some of the cruise lines. Yep. They go to buy RCL and CCL. They talk about this bear case that's been emerging regarding sort of a wind down of the pent-up demand, but they argue that there's better pricing initiatives, more structural things going on in the business that keep them bullish. The other thing is this page one New York Times piece about that Alaska Airlines flight where the door panel blew out. The Times reporting that engineers were concerned enough about the flight that some wanted to take it out of service. Airline decided to keep it in service long enough for it to get back to Portland where it could undergo maintenance. Not really having an impact on Airbus, although Boeing shares lately are almost retracing the trip up from the October lows.
Yeah, they're under some pressure and just a ton of street commentary about it. You know, for the most part, it seems as if people are just saying it's production's going to come back. You know, this cap that on production in terms of the MAX is not that relevant because they're operating intentionally under it for now. But it still defers this moment of real lush free cash flow generation that is the basis of all the bullish calls on the street. I mean, you know, you look and say, I think it was Baird, who still likes the stock, saying, okay, the 10 billion in free cash flow is maybe more like 2026. And that's the basis of their price target. So it's been a struggle for Boeing to kind of find its footing because it seems like the second round of all this, when we had to kind of rewrite the schedule for when they were really going to be profitable. I guess the other question is, just given the pressure on management and scrutiny and everything, can they be a company that says, we're firing on all cylinders, we're just harvesting a bunch of free cash flow, and you know, maybe it's not the biggest priority as it once was. You got to show that you're spending to make sure that production is locked down.
Does there become a question at some point about the board's culpability? I mean, just what exactly has been going on longer term here at this company?
I mean, given the commentary of their customers, the CEOs of the airlines, and, you know, really turning up the heat, I guess it should be a question.
Look at what Southwest said yesterday. Yeah. By the way, Jefferies does up Southwest today, but only to a hold. But that's a very much a Boeing story at Southwest. Finally, Mike, I wonder if you'd touch on Bitcoin. 73K today, all-time high. A lot of discussion about how much the Fed's watching this as some of these ETFs cut fees to draw in those flows?
I don't know if the Fed had. First of all, I guess you would look at it as a, you know, does this show frothy financial conditions and some level of speculation that they wouldn't want to stoke by cutting rates? You know, arguably, I guess it's part of that equation. And then the question of, you know, financial stability, I don't really think it plays into that. I don't think there's a right or wrong price for this thing. Never was, you know, at 12,000 or at 60 or 70. It's much more about, you know, gold's at a record, people wanting to find alternatives. And as equities go higher, you know, in theory, if you're rebalancing into the everything else basket, it seems to be there. So I don't know. I've certainly not been right about it up to this point, so I can't say it.
We'll keep an eye on it. Meantime, we'll watch bonds as well. We mentioned some of the elevated yields earlier on today. No data, although we will get a 30-year note auction later this afternoon after the 10-year yesterday was a little sticky. Meantime, Dow's up 64, S&P split down 7. Be right back. Keep your eye on Lilly today, bringing on Amazon and the pharmacy unit there to deliver prescriptions direct to consumer via its service Lilly Direct. That includes Zepbound. David Ricks, guys, I don't know if you saw, was talking at the Economic Club in New York yesterday, saying consumers want a direct relationship with the product provider, because I haven't been to a department store in 15 years, and a pharmacy is kind of like a department store.
Interesting, yeah. Well, certainly no love for the pharmacy benefit managers and everybody else.
No.
So, yeah.
Mark Cuban will tell you that.
Yeah.
Meantime, Dow's up almost 70. Back in two. Welcome back to Squawk on the Street. Our Bob Pisani's here taking a closer look at the open, at least so far, Bob.
Yeah, important thing is it's one of those days, again, where let's sell off technology. Let's buy a little bit into the broader market. Just take a look at what's going on today. I don't find this terribly disturbing. I think it's healthy for the market. We see energy stocks doing a little better, bank stocks, material names doing a little bit better overall. Consumer staples actually were up. Tech is generally down. There you see the sectors. There you see what's moving on the upside and what's on the downside. Of course, the big cap semis, this is one of those days. You know, you just impulsively pull back on some of the biggest performers for the year here. So you get AMD, Micron, NVIDIA, Broadcom moving to the downside, Intel, all sort of knee-jerk reaction moving down here. What's very interesting is the market is sort of obsessed with two factors right now, factors in an investment sense, that is quality and momentum. And they have essentially diverged. They are the same thing at this point. So if you look at the quality leaders that are out there that show up on quality screens, quality, by the way, is high return on equity, stable earnings growth, those kinds of things, NVIDIA, Meta, Broadcom shows up all of the time. Lilly shows up. Amazon shows up. Microsoft shows up. Visa shows up all the time. And then you look at the momentum, it's virtually the same thing. So quality and momentum have converged this year. And you see, same thing. NVIDIA, Meta, Broadcom, Lilly, Amazon, Microsoft, Visa, all converged together. And what that means is the market is really obsessed with a small group of names. So, of course, these exist in the classic ETF. There's the quality ETF, QUAL, Momentum, MTUM. And they have traded pretty much in tandem this year. Now, you see the quality is doing a little bit better. The mix is a little different. Sometimes NVIDIA and Meta has a stronger mix in one versus the other. But you get the idea. They're essentially moving pretty much in tandem. So I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but it's one of the reasons you get such tight movement in a small group of stocks when the market converges around two factors that have become very important. The other two factors that used to move the market, which is value and small caps, really have sort of fallen away as a major issue. So here's where we are right now. This is what you call a frustrating market in a good way. We're moving forward. Everything is doing well. The market is broadening out a little bit, but it's frustrating because it just sort of feels the same way. What do we had? 16, 17, 18 new highs this year. It's hard to create a new narrative around this. So there's no catalyst right now for a meaningful pullback. What we have to have is a change in the macro narrative, the underpinning. So either you have to have some kind of economic slowdown that we need to worry about that's very obvious in a series of numbers that show up, or we have to have some kind of inflation worries reaccelerating, causing us to be worried about the Federal Reserve coming out and increasing rates. Neither of those things are happening, and the CPI yesterday certainly didn't change that narrative. Friday, guys, we're going to get the quarterly expiration of stock index options and index futures, triple witching. Mike, we've talked about this for years. It's less impactful because of the monthly and the weeklies. And also
and the dailies.
And the zero date expiration. Yeah. But when you get straight line up in the S&P 500, it's not interesting when it rolls over because everybody is essentially zeroed out on their positions. There's no things that stick out. You don't have any weird positions betting on big drops, big moves on the upside. So it's kind of like unexciting.
Yeah.
It's boring, but in a good way. It's funny.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of call options that are in the money, and you got to see how people maybe reposition around that in the leading stocks. But you're right. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of drama.
Okay.
Bob, thanks. And Mike, thanks to you, Mike Santoli. Coming up in the next hour, we'll take you to D.C. We'll watch for that House vote to ban TikTok, so don't go anywhere.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.